a three-week class rather than a three-day class. So we are really skimming the surface, but hopefully we can touch on some things that will be helpful. We saw that military historian C. Sanders cited that there are three basic principles of historiography, which is a fancy way of saying there are three basic tests that we can apply to any historical document, be it sacred or secular, by which we can determine if that document is trustworthy history. And so we decided, or I decided yesterday, and hopefully you're along for the ride, to put the Bible to the test. Let's be logical. Let's be fair. Let's not believe in the Bible just because Rick Sparks said so. Let's not believe in the Bible just because Mom and Dad said so. Let's trust the Bible because that's where the evidence has taken us. And there are all different kinds of evidence. We began yesterday with what I call the bibliographical test. I got that from someone else, but it's a fair title. That answers the question, is the text we're reading what was originally written? And what were the two main categories of information we looked at to determine whether or not this text is actually what was written? We first of all looked at the number of manuscripts. And what is a manuscript? All right, a copy of it in the original language. And, of course, in making a copy, how did they do it? They did it by hand. So, handwritten copy of a document in its original language. You might have a scribe who would translate it into another language, and that translation copy might be very ancient, but technically it's not a manuscript in the strictest sense. So, the New Testament was originally written in Greek, and how many Greek manuscripts of the New Testament do we have? Close. Oh, you transpose. 5,686. 5,686, and we saw that not... And how did that fare against other ancient works? Who holds second place for the number of manuscripts? Homer, 643. So the best attested ancient document is Homer after the New Testament, and he has nine times fewer manuscripts to verify the text we're reading. Furthermore, in comparison with other ancient works, how does the Bible fare on the dating of the manuscripts? Well, they're all closer to the time of the original autograph, the time of the original writing, than anything we have from ancient history. So for someone to say, well, I don't think I can really trust that this is the stuff that was originally written, the logical conclusion of that reasoning is, I can't trust anything. And no one goes there. And no one should. Even though the oldest piece of Homer's writing we have comes 400 years later, even though the oldest piece of Tacitus's writing comes 1,000 years later, because of the way scribes worked, we're reading things that are reliable representations of the original. All right, so we looked at that, and then we went to this internal evidence test. Okay, so we're reading what was originally written. That still does not necessarily mean that what was originally written was legitimate. And we likened to someone finding a copy of an article from The Onion in 300 years from now, or maybe something from the National Enquirer. They might have exactly what was written, but what was written was bogus from the very beginning. So what about the New Testament? Does it bear the marks of legitimate history? And we looked at some things, just some logical considerations, which indicate, yeah. The gospel writers included all kinds of very unflattering information about the apostles, the holy apostles. People who, if we were making the decisions, or Christians just 300 years after the fact were making the decisions, they probably would have painted them very perfectly and idyllically, if that's even a word. But the gospel writers didn't do that. We get a Peter who's bungling with some frequency, as well as the other apostles. In other words, a realistic picture is being painted. This is the result of honest history. Furthermore, we saw that the frequency of names and the distribution of names in the New Testament matched up exactly with the frequency and distribution of names among Jews in Palestine in secular writings of the time. That was some pretty good guesswork if the Bible's bogus history. So all those things, as well as many, many more were skimming the surface, would indicate that we're looking at a book that is real history. Now some will say, well, contradictions though, John. I hear there are a lot of contradictions in the Bible. In fact, I've even looked at a few of them. I hope in the next week or so to meet with a gentleman who, to his credit, he is not a member of the church, has been reading the Bible on his own accord for some time, it would appear. And he has put together a multi-page document in which he has found things that appear to him like they might disagree, or he doesn't know how to make sense of them. And there are times when we might read the Bible and at the outset things would appear to disagree. In fact, there are websites and books devoted to this. Let's take an example. Variations in language. And again, looking at the Gospels. This is the most common kind of difference between Gospel accounts. Let's look at an example. Matthew chapter 3, verse 17. Would someone read that for us? Matthew 3, 17. Can I erase this way temporarily?
I guess I can.
Okay, Matthew chapter 3, verse 17. We have the Father speaking from heaven when Jesus comes up out of the waters of baptism. Would someone read it for us, please? This is my Son, whom I love. And what was the last part of it? With whom I am well pleased. All right. So, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.
Like, why are you writing those words on the board, John?
Well, hang with me. Mark chapter 1, verse 11. Would someone read Mark's account of the exact same event? Mark chapter 1, verse 11. So Mark says that God said from heaven, what? You are my beloved Son. And what's the next half of the statement? Mark 1:11. You are my beloved Son. Does it say, with you I am well pleased? Okay. Yes. Interesting. Well, all right, here's what's going on there. I think if we find time, we can talk a little bit about translations. This is a demonstrative pronoun. This is a relative pronoun. And this is a personal pronoun. In the Greek, it was a relative pronoun. Some of our more dynamic equivalent translators to help us along switched it to a personal pronoun. Is that a big deal? No. But this is the more literal and accurate, and I'm sure the same is the case here. But I think what I'm wanting us to see will still stand. Let's look at a third account of this same event. Luke chapter 3, verse 22. Luke chapter 3, verse 22. And so that you're reading from the correct translation, would someone please read from the New King James? No, you don't have to. It doesn't matter. Luke 3, 22. Mark 1:11 read again? Whom? I thought, yeah. It's no big deal.
It'll help illustrate.
We have three accounts of what God said from heaven when Jesus came up from the waters of baptism. This is my beloved Son, whom I am well pleased. You are my beloved Son, whom I am well pleased. You are my beloved Son, whom I am well pleased. Contradiction, right? I could understand someone thinking so. The thing is, I would be judging, to say that, I would be judging an ancient Eastern document by modern Western standards. And that is misinformed and leads me to misunderstandings. We are real sticklers about exact quotation. But we've only been that way for about 100 years. And why is that? What's led to the change? Why can we be such sticklers about exact wording? with people. Like, I can know exactly what Ronald Reagan said at his Republican National Convention speech in 19, whatever that was, 80. I can know exactly what he said. And if someone says, well, Ronald Reagan said thus and so, I can go back, oh, no. He actually said this. But how am I able to do that? Recording technology. There's television, there's audio, there's all of this. You go back a little over 100 years, and what had the human race been doing for the whole rest of history? They'd been working on something other than recording technology. Greek and Hebrew, the language in which the New Testament is almost, the Bible is almost entirely written in, they didn't even have anything like quotation marks. Language is a reflection of how a culture thinks. And the ancients did not look for exact quotation as we do. They couldn't. That wasn't the world they lived in. So when you picked up an ancient document as an ancient reader, you didn't expect exact quotation. It was understood by the writer as well as the reader that the writer was free to paraphrase what had been said so long as the writer was true to the meaning. And in these passages, has the meaning been changed in any way? No. God has said Jesus is His Son. And how does He feel about Jesus? He was well pleased with Him. The ideas have not been affected at all, regardless of whether you use personal, demonstrative, or relative pronouns. The message got through. And so when we see differences in language sometimes with how Jesus has said a thing from one account to the other, we're not looking at contradictions. What we're looking at is the way ancients handled history. The content is there. The truth is there. Exact wording may or may not be there. Okay. But John, I notice sometimes that things are in different order. I mean, I'm reading in this gospel and Jesus does this A, B, and C, but then I go over to this gospel and it's B, A, C. Isn't that a contradiction? And in fact, this is a major reason some critics question the gospel's reliability. They'll say things are not in the same order. These guys don't really know. And we're saying one thing and another guy was saying the other. How would you respond to that? It is true that among the gospel accounts, you will find things recorded in different order at times. Any thoughts? The problem is the premise, as is so often the case with discussions we have with people. Wade's been building on that and almost many of the discussions we have with people. The problem is not with the reasoning. The problem is the premise from which the reasoning started. Chronological exactness only matters if I'm writing a biography. If I'm seeking to write something that is chronologically exact and give you a play-by-play itinerary of a person's life and in Jesus' case, ministry. Is that what the gospel writers were trying to do? No. And how do I know that? Well, it's kind of obvious. If I go to the bookstore or I go to the library and I pick up a biography on almost anybody, if it's written for an adult, how big is that book? It's a big old book. I have 4 works about Jesus at the beginning of my New Testament, and altogether they're like that thick. The gospel writers mention a few things surrounding Jesus' birth. They mention one event when he's a toddler, because that's when the Magi come over from the east. Then they skip all the way to when he's 12. They tell one story about when he's 12, and then they say nothing else about his life until he's almost 30 years old. And then they talk about 3.5 years of his life in very few pages. Are they trying to write biographies? No way. There's something else at work. John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Let's look at that real quick. Because John tells us outright that he intentionally was leaving stuff out. John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. You know these verses. And truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name. John says, I have left out all sorts of things that Jesus did. I could fill the earth with them. But I have left them out. I have given you enough because my goal was so that you will believe. The gospel writers were clearly including or excluding things based upon a number of criteria. For example, did all the gospel writers have the same goal in mind? You say, well, yeah, they all wanted us to believe about Jesus. Well, yes, in that sense, they had the same goal. But there are some very distinct goals. For example, when you go to the book of Matthew, how does Matthew begin? Begins with what? Yeah, a genealogy. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. And then it stops. And then after that, it goes to this long list, such and such begat such and such, such and such begat such and such. And all those names, where else have I seen them? The Old Testament. And then as I read through Matthew over and over and over, I read Jesus did a certain thing or such a thing happened in order that the prophet might be fulfilled. So that which was spoken might be fulfilled by that which is spoken by the prophet might be fulfilled saying. If I go to Mark, Luke and John, I don't encounter nearly that much. In fact, it may be you could take all the prophecies quoted in Mark, Luke, and John, and you still have fewer than are quoted in the book of Matthew. Why is Matthew taking the genealogy of Jesus only back to Abraham when he could have taken it further? Why is he quoting the Old Testament prophets all the time? And why is he citing all these things from the Old Testament? Who's he obviously writing to? Jews. I knew a Jewish man who was raised in Israel. He was taught all through his childhood the New Testament is a Gentile book. It's not for us Jews. It's a Gentile book. But he had an uncle who had become a Christian. And so when he's 16 years old, out of curiosity, he picks up his New Testament. He opens up to the book of Matthew and he says, I come to Matthew. I've been told all my life it's a Gentile book. And who am I reading about? Abraham. I'm reading about all these Jewish names and all these Jewish people. Matthew was trying to help the Jews see that Jesus was their Messiah. But I go over to the book of Luke, Luke chapter 3. Luke gives us a genealogy, but he doesn't just go back to Abraham. How far back does he go? Anybody know? Let's go over there. Luke chapter 3. Luke chapter 3. I'll give you the verse here in a second. Luke chapter 3, starting in verse 23. Now, Jesus himself began his ministry at about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, the son of Heli, son of Mathat. We won't read them all. Go all the way down to verse 37. The son of Methuselah, the son of Enoch, the son of Jared, the son of Mahalalel, the son of Kainan, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of who? Adam. And of course, Adam was the son of God because there was no one to father Adam except God. But insofar as humanity is concerned, Luke goes all the way back to Adam. Matthew stops at Abraham. Luke goes all the way back to Adam. What might Luke be trying to tell us? Jesus isn't just the Messiah for the Jews. He's the Christ for the whole world. And if I look through the book of Luke, that all begins to fit. Was Luke a Jew or a Gentile? He was a Gentile. I have Matthew, a Jew, writing for Jews. I have Luke, a Gentile, writing for Gentiles. Jesus is your Christ, too. And Luke talks about all the downcast people that others, that people disregarded in their time. Luke writes more about the women. Women who supported Jesus financially. Women who were there as a part of Jesus' life. Women who were following him and Jesus' words to them and his interactions with them. Luke is the only one who tells us about Zacchaeus. What was Zacchaeus? Tax collector. What did the Jews think about tax collectors? They were traitors. They were heretics. They had sided with the enemy. And here's Luke telling us about how Jesus actually tells a tax collector, I'm coming to your house today. And then goes to his house and tells him salvation has come to this house. Luke is helping us see that Jesus is the Messiah for everybody. John doesn't even bother to record for us Jesus' birth. Where does he begin? Mark quoted it for us last night. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So I've been blabbing a long time on this. The point is, when we look at the Gospels, we can see that the intended audience was different, The intended goals were different. And their organization was clearly not chronological. It's evident when you start looking at it carefully. For example, in Matthew chapters 8 and 9, there's a concentration of healing stories. Luke chapters 14 and 15 and 16, there's a concentration of parables. Matthew chapter 13, we get 8 straight parables about the kingdom of God. Did Jesus really stand there and go bang, 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 bang at people? Well, maybe. But maybe Matthew's putting that all in one place so we can read it and study it all together and get a well-rounded, multifaceted picture that Jesus gave over time, but Matthew puts it in one place for us. The Gospels highlight character and content. They're not about chronology, with one possible exception, and I will try not to make this too confusing, but you might find it interesting.
I have no idea how I'm going to do this because I've never found a good way to explain it. So I'm going to try this. All right, now Matthew, Mark, and Luke are sometimes called the synoptic gospels. Syn, synchronized, synonym. Syn means same. Optic means you see. They look the same. They involve a lot of the same content. John's very different. When Matthew and Mark.
Let me get my notes here. I'll never be able to say this right without these in front of me. All right.
When it comes to the order of Jesus' ministry, Mark and Matthew will sometimes agree, but not agree with Luke. Mark and Luke will sometimes agree, but not agree with Matthew. But whenever Matthew and Luke agree, they always agree with Mark. Did you follow that? Do it again. Alright, so Matthew and Mark will sometimes agree on order, but they won't agree with Luke. Matthew and Luke will sometimes agree on order, but disagree with Mark. But whenever... I did it wrong, didn't I? Thank you. Mark and Luke. Oh, man, see, there you go. I'm not being trusted. Mark and Luke sometimes agree, they will agree against Matthew. But whenever Matthew and Luke agree on the order, they always agree with Mark. In other words, this is called the Marking Hypothesis. I love how theologians like to come up with fancy names to sound smart. It's really foolishness. The simplicity of the gospel is completely betrayed by that kind of stuff. In other words, there's some evidence to suggest that Mark might actually be giving us the order. Mark's is the shortest gospel. Mark we keep encountering straightway or immediately, immediately, immediately. Mark might be giving us the actual order. But again, the gospels are not biographies. And they should not be treated as such. Any comments thus far? Mark? We could talk about that. Yeah. I didn't know. We're hopefully going to talk a little bit about canonization tomorrow. Oh, okay. Panel. Bring it up in panel. Sounds good. Yeah, the panel gets real long real quick. Everything gets deferred. All right, so another question. We've got 4 witnesses, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I'm going to read this off my notes. Why didn't God just give us one gospel account and avoid all the potential misunderstandings? Why didn't he just give us 4 witnesses that, or why didn't he just give us 4 witnesses that recounted things in identical language? Then we wouldn't have to worry about all this. We wouldn't have all this confusion. Why? What do you think? Why 4 witnesses? What's the advantage, Maddie? I think that's right. That was Judas.
There was someone who liked numbers, is all I remember. And they like always counted and things like feeding the 5,000 and feeding the 4,000.
Oh, that might be who it.
Oh, and he gives a lot more of the numerical details.
Cool. But God could have set it up where all that information got compiled and put in one nice, neat package, and we could just take that package and read it all through, and there wouldn't be all this confusion. Why didn't he do it? Kirsten? Okay. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I won't disagree with it. The thing is, the less we know about a thing, the easier it is to speculate about it. And there could be truth in that. I mean, there's an interesting story about how John wrote his gospel. I won't bother to tell. I saw a hand over here somewhere. Mark? Yes. Yes. Yeah, the law of Moses said you could not convict someone of a crime unless there were at least two or three witnesses. We saw yesterday when we were talking about evangelists very briefly, or all I was, how an evangelist is not to receive accusations against an elder unless at least two or three witnesses come to him from that congregation. So what has God done? God has said, I require two or three, I'll go you one better. I will give you four. I will go over and above what I require. And God does that frequently. When Jesus fed the 5,000, what did He do? He fed everybody, and then you had 12 baskets left over. When He feeds the 4,000, 7 baskets left over. God's blessings are pressed down, shaken together, and running over. He's given us 4. 3 would have done the job. But something else. Let's say you and I are sitting in a jury. It's a murder case. Moral evil. And 4 witnesses are brought forward by the prosecution. And as we listen to the 4 witnesses, we notice they all describe the event in the exact same way, in the exact same language. The hearing's over, and we're meeting in our conference room. And what are you thinking as a juror? Yeah, it was rehearsed. We call that collusion. These folks got together, they agreed on what we're going to testify so that it would agree. But if we're sitting in the jury and the prosecution brings forth 4 witnesses and they all describe the same events, but they do, some of them leave out certain details and others include others, and they say it in different words, but we can look at it and carefully find how it all can be brought together, then we know we've got real witnesses and a case we can make a legitimate conclusion on. That's what God has done. 4 witnesses is far superior to 1. God's given us some so we can compare them. And the fact they don't say it exactly the same is what we would expect from honest witnesses. Now, let's talk about miracles. And we're almost done with the internal evidence test, and we'll move on to the third and final one. Miracles. This is a chief reason why some people reject the account found in the Gospels. And it does go back to David Hume, which Wade was talking about. Our culture is kind of experiencing what we could call a Hume hangover. Hume said, belief in something is only justified. I can only justify believing in something if, number one, what I'm being asked to believe in is probable. It's got to be probable. And how do you determine if something is probable? He said it has to conform to human experience. Anybody here ever seen a miracle? And let me define what I mean by miracle. The word miracle is used 16 times in the New Testament. And every single time it's used in the New Testament, in the Bible, it's referring to a miraculous action that God is performing through an individual. where I come and lay hands on someone who can't walk and suddenly they can walk. Where Jesus touches his hand to a man's eyes and suddenly he can see. That's the biblical definition of miracle. Anybody here ever seen a miracle like that? Well, David Hume had neither. And he didn't know anybody who'd seen a miracle like that. And he said, so if I look at my human experience, miracles don't happen. Therefore, it's improbable, and therefore, it's unjustifiable to believe in them. What's the problem with that kind of thinking? What's that? Elaborate. All right. Very true. David Hume's outlook, and many people who we talk to who deny the Gospels based on the miracles, they're working with what we would call a closed system. They're saying that, and they're saying it without evidence, that things have always been the way they are. Is the present always the key to the past? Couldn't possibly be. Things have happened in the past that have no parallel in the present and may never happen again. Can anyone say, based on scientific, observable evidence, that miracles have never happened? No. Science requires observation. And can you and I observe the past? No. So when people say, I reject miracles, what they are making is a philosophical objection, not a scientific one, like they like to think they are. They're saying, I've never seen them. I don't know anybody who sees them. People don't see them. Therefore, they've never been seen. It's not a very good form of reasoning. C.S. Lewis put it this way. We know the experience against miracles to be uniform, in other words, consistent, only if we know that all the reports of them are false. And we know all the reports of them to be false only if we know already that miracles have never occurred. We are arguing in a circle. We are assuming what we attempt to prove, and then we are approving it based upon the assumption. So what reasons do people have to believe in the miracles of the Bible? Well, we've only just gotten started, but we have seen that there's internal evidence to suggest that the Bible is giving us reliable, honest, and authentic history. We're getting ready to go to the external evidence test, which we're going to start looking at history and archaeology. We're not going to have time to look at prophecy. A whole host of things we could look at. But the Gospels, we're taking the Gospels, they have shown us thus far that when it comes to non-religious things, are they reliable history? Yeah, we're going to find there's all kinds of historical and archaeological evidence to confirm them. So, I'm belaboring this. Hang with me if you will. Here is the point. If the Gospels can be shown to be reliable in non-religious, non-spiritual history, on what grounds would I dismiss their testimony about miracles out of hand? If they've shown me that they are honest and reliable historians on everything else, and then they come along and say, and by the way, this fella, he raised from the dead, on what grounds do I say, oh, no, he didn't. I believed everything else they said. If they were honest there, might they be honest on this point too? And if I've got no other evidence to the contrary, which I don't, I've got reason to believe it. That's where we're coming from. Any comments or questions on that? Two more quick things. If Jesus was who he said he was, miracles make sense. Don't they? I mean, if God really came down from heaven in the flesh, and God is interested in our welfare and wants to have a relationship with us and wants us to spend eternity with him and wants us to trust his messenger, miracles make sense. Miracles only are a problem if we take the deist point of view or the atheist point of view. If we take the theist point of view, that there is a God who made us and who is interested in us, miracles make sense. And if that God sent His Son to the earth, miracles are not only possible and probable, they're expected. It adds up. Not to mention the miracles are very much in character. I don't know if any of you have read about the claimed miracles, I don't know, maybe starting like in the 400s A.D., the Venerable Bede. Here's a book out there. He was writing about miracles which had occurred in the much later centuries. And they're goofy miracles. I mean, really. You're reading them and you're like, it's kind of silly sounding. Jesus doesn't perform silly miracles. Helpful, compassionate, kind miracles. Okay, let's move on to this one. The external evidence test simply asks, does outside historical material confirm or deny the internal testimony of the document in question? Do we have stuff outside of it? Are there any other sources to substantiate its accuracy, reliability, authenticity, like historical documents? Not modern historical documents, but ancient historical documents. Contemporary or soon thereafter historical documents. Do they confirm? Are there archaeological finds to confirm? And you know what my answer to this is going to be. So, can I have some help passing these out? Anybody else be willing to help? I'd just like everybody to have one. I printed off 40. I hope everybody can get one. What I'd like to take us through are 8 different ancient writers. We could have cited a lot more. We could have cited a lot more. We're just going to look at 8 that make reference to Jesus. These were not Christians. In fact, we're going to find that at least some of them were just outright hostile to Christianity. But they spoke of Jesus and some of the events in His life and things that transpired in the New Testament as historical realities. And by the way, the top of the form says secular sources confirming Jesus' existence. I regret that title. This was a form I had put together quite a few years ago, and I decided to add to it a little bit for our class. And it really shouldn't be just confirming Jesus' existence. You could scratch out Jesus' existence and say secular sources confirming New Testament people and events, because it's really broader than Jesus, although all of it will relate to Jesus. So again, let me be clear. This could be a whole lot longer. We are only citing a few. We could fill several more pages with ancient historical writings which line up with the testimony of the Bible. So let's start with Tacitus. Cornelius Tacitus. He lived somewhere about A.D. 55 to A.D. 120, which means he was born 20 to 25 years after Jesus was crucified. He has been called the greatest Roman historian in the days of the empire. He lived through the reigns of over 6 Roman emperors. He was himself a Roman consul, a Roman senate, a Roman governor. And as an historian, and I mentioned it yesterday, but as an historian, he is regarded by historians, secular and sacred, those who believe in the Bible and those who don't, rather, as a historian of integrity. Okay, he's taken as legitimate history. He is best known for 2 of his works, and we're going to be looking at both of them briefly. His Annals and his Histories. His Annals concern the period of time from Caesar Augustus's death to the death of Nero in 64 A.D., and then his Histories pick up right after the death of Nero and go all the way to the death of Domitian in A.D. 96. So he covers a space of almost exactly 100 years in the life of the Roman Empire. He mentions Jesus once. He refers to Christianity a couple of times. The quote we're reading here was written A.D. 115 when Tacitus is about 60 years old. And let me give you a little context for the quote. How many of you have heard of the fire in Rome that Nero supposedly started? Can I see some hands? Okay, thank you. Rome had 14 districts. And when the fire was done, only 4 of them remained intact. 3 had been totally leveled. Tacitus says 7 were reduced to a few scorched and mangled ruins. So if, I don't know how long ago Katrina was. I'm dating myself here. Some of you may were probably watching cartoons when that whole thing was going down in New Orleans. But and that's okay that you were watching cartoons. I'm not being critical there. I'd like to watch some cartoons. But the city was almost entirely decimated. And after the destruction, Nero got to rebuild the city in his own image. Well, while this was going on, or soon thereafter, the people of the city, and I don't know all the reasons for it, but they began to think that Nero was the one who had started the fire, as well he may have been. Well, Nero was a politician. You say, well, he's emperor. He doesn't have to care. Well, yeah, even an emperor has to care. He needs to get people on his side if he doesn't want to be killing people all the time. So he needed to find a scapegoat. So he chose a group of people that were kind of already on people's radar. He chose the Christians. And here's what Tacitus writes. Consequently, to get rid of the report, that is, that he was the one who started the fire, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, that's Latin for Christ, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus, again Latin. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for a moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of what? I'm looking for an answer. As of what? Does that sound familiar? If you're a Christian and you say, I believe the Bible, and I believe the Bible says that homosexuality is a sin and it's wrong, and I believe, according to the Bible, there's only one way to heaven, and that's Jesus Christ, what are you? Aren't you a hater? There's nothing new under the sun. Roman people were pulling the same games that people pull today. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. We don't need to read that second paragraph. It's there for you to read to see how Christians were being treated. But notice, it says in that well, let's just go down through it. Number one, we have a mention of Christ on the second line. The third line, the second line says they were called Christians. Where were the disciples first called Christians, by the way? And this is from the Bible. Acts 11:26. Where were the disciples first called Christians? Antioch. It's a good verse to have. God promised that His people would get a new name. And I think Christian is that new name. They were called Christians, and their name was originated from the man they followed, that is Christus. Notice he says there in the third line that Christus had suffered the extreme penalty. He'd been executed during the reign of who? Tiberius. Luke chapter 3, verse 1 says that John the Baptist began his ministry in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. Tiberius began reigning in 14 A.D. He reigned till 37 A.D. Jesus was executed during the reign of Tiberius. We could know that without Tacitus telling us, but Tacitus tells us. It all lines up with what the Bible has shown us so far. And notice also it says, after it says Pontius Pilate there on line 4, and it says the most mischievous superstition, because that's how Tacitus regarded Christianity, thus checked for the moment. In other words, when Jesus was killed, it stopped it for a moment. Again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. What might he be referring to there? Jesus is crucified, and you remember the disciples are like, we thought he was the Messiah. This is not working like we thought. What happened 50 days later? Pentecost. Acts 2, the Holy Spirit descends upon the apostles. It's evident to all those people gathered in Jerusalem who would have been in the millions at Pentecost that God was at work among these men. 3,000 souls were added to the church in just that one day, and Christianity began to spread like wildfire. I wonder if that's exactly what Tacitus is talking about. Jesus was killed, and it seemed to cut the thing off for a while, but then it broke out again in Judea, which is, I guess, of course, exactly what the Bible said. Let's go to the next quote, Suetonius. We don't know a whole lot about Suetonius. We do know he was the chief secretary for the Roman Emperor Hadrian. who reigned between A.D. 117 and A.D. 138. In that role, he would have had access to the imperial records, which would be a pretty sweet place to be in if you like history. He's written a number of things which we call the lives of the Caesars. In his lives, he makes one reference to Christians, one possible reference to Jesus. He talks about that, how the Christians were blamed for what Nero may have done to the city in his life of Nero, book 16, section 2. Here in this quote, he's talking about a wave of riots which had hit the Jewish community in Rome in A.D. 49. And he says, as the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, that is Claudius, the emperor, expelled them from Rome. Now, when Tacitus talked about Jesus, what did he call him?
You know how to pronounce it right, but he called him this, right? Christus, Latin for Christ. Suetonius doesn't say exactly that. What's he say? Crestus, he's got this E there instead of an I. Now, authorities tell us that Crestus was an alternate spelling of Christus among Gentiles. And that may well be. However, this is A.D. 49. Where is Jesus in A.D. 49? What's that? Yeah, he's in heaven in A.D. 49. And yet Suetonius is saying the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus. Now, if Crestus is Jesus, how do we make sense of that? Well, it may simply be that the gospel has come into Rome. The Jewish community has not responded to it very well, as they didn't respond to it well in other places. And Suetonius, not being terribly well informed, just assumes this Crestus fellow is among them. Or it couldn't be. It might not be Jesus at all. And that's a very real possibility. But I do want you to notice the second part of it. What did Claudius do as a result of these riots among the Jews? He expelled them from Rome. Would someone please read Acts chapter 18, verse 2. Acts chapter 18, verse 2. So Paul hooks up with Aquila and Priscilla. He meets them, and they had just come from Rome. And why had they left Rome? Because Claudius had expelled the Jews from Rome, just like Suetonius says. So, again, we have biblical history and secular history matching up. I've got these other authors I'm hoping we can take a look at. Please hold on to this. It's yours. If you have it with you tomorrow, we'll take a look at some of this. Considering the pace at which we moved through Tacitus and Suetonius, we're going to have to do something a little different. But I want to continue on this at least a little bit tomorrow. Are there any closing questions or comments or anything related to this you want to bring up? Well, thanks for your time. 10 minutes.